It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We've been keeping up with WPR reporter Shemaine Mills on flooding in the Baraboo area. But aside from the height of the river and sandbagging efforts, Baraboo is a tourist destination, and the flooding was happening the last holiday weekend of summer. So what is the effect on flooding on tourism? Lisa Marshall is the communications director of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, and she joins us now. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
Is it too early to tell how tourist industries were affected here?
Well, it is early. We'll get our economic impact reports next spring, and we will look to see if there's been any impact on some of these harder hit counties at that time.
Are you hearing some anecdotal stories, though?
Well, I'm going to say that, you know, the flooding was really, it's not widespread. And we've heard anecdotally areas like Door County, the North Woods, you know, other areas of the state have been business as usual. However, there have been some really hard hit counties, Vernon, Sauk, Richland, Crawford. We're really thinking about these folks. And I know we have staff members that are calling them on a consistent basis to see how they're doing.
What has been affected most? Has it been the tourist destinations themselves or travel to them?
A little bit, you know, both. I would say really statewide it was getting to your destination. A lot of roads were out. You know, you had I-90-94 was out for a while, and that certainly impacts people getting to their destination. But in these harder hit areas, what we're seeing was damage to outdoor recreation areas. I think that's probably been the biggest thing. You know, we have Wildcat Mountain State Park closed, and the rivers are high, which means it's not safe to kayak or paddle. Probably affects some fishing as well. So it's really been more like outdoor recreation in this localized area.
Interesting. And should we be worried about the lost revenue when you see these reports come spring?
Well, you know, I will say this. This is not the first year we've had severe weather, flooding in Wisconsin. And it's, you know, the tourism industry, you know, it's a resilient one. And, you know, businesses plan for, you know, there's going to be downtimes. Mother Nature is not something they can control.
That's true.
But the economy and Mother Nature, those are probably the two biggest things that are going to impact tourism. So, you know, individual businesses, this could, you know, they could be very hard hit. If you had a paddling outfitter, you know, on the Baraboo River, you're going to lose some lost revenue. Hopefully you make that up once you get back going again the following year, because there's going to be ups and downs, and I think that's just part of having a small business.
Remind us how valuable tourism is in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a $20.6 billion industry, and, you know, tourism is in all 72 counties, and it supports 195,000 jobs in the state. So it's big. You know, we have amazing natural resources and great attractions, and we're lucky. We have, Chicago to the south. You got Minneapolis to our northwest. And so those destinations are huge cities that are bringing in travelers. Basically, we're importing dollars from those from outside of the state.
And is there anything the state can do to help the tourism destinations that have been hit by these water surges?
Yeah. Well, you know, like I said, we have a field rep that's checking in with them to see how we can support them. I know the DNR, I've talked to our colleagues over there, and they're working hard to get some of these bike trails and state parks cleaned up and open for business. And they're usually, it's pretty fast. But what we'll do is, as things start to get, you know, when they're ready, we'll really go out of our way to get the word out that they're open for business. You know, we'll be promoting them, you know, making sure we raise their profile so that people know. Because, you know, right now in people's mind, it's all in your – they think, oh, that area, I should stay away. Well, once we know everything's good to go, we're going to really shine the light on them.
So let's say this weekend I want to go biking, and I want to go biking somewhere, you know, near Baraboo or somewhere that was hit. Is there a website I can go to? Should I call somebody? How do I find out?
Well, first of all, I would check if you're looking at, you know, just where I should go this weekend, we would recommend travelwisconsin.com. If you're looking at a state bike trail, definitely check the DNR, the Wisconsin DNR website, because they have the closures listed. You know, right now, I think it's the 400 State Trail, the Elroy, Sparta, Military Ridge, and Dane counties have some places that are out. And if you're driving anywhere, because I do believe there are still some road closures in this western part of the state, to check the 511wi.gov, and they have road closures listed right on their homepage.
So one of the things that I was looking at your website is fall colors.
Yeah.
Because it is starting to be fall. My family is very excited. We've been living in the desert for the last 5 years, so we finally get to see fall again. Where are the best places to go, and when do we expect the colors to be at their height?
Well, actually, from what I'm talking with some folks at the DNR last week, they already said that colors are changing in the far northern part of the state. So just starting to turn. And what we'll see is it's sort of a gradual progression starting in northern Wisconsin and working its way south. So expect, I'm trying to get the second weekend of, or oh my gosh, third weekend of September. You know, it'll probably start peaking up there in the next 2 weeks, and then we'll see it peak down here in southern Wisconsin right before Halloween, typically. And by Halloween, by November 1st, we're pretty much done with fall color here.
Okay, that is good to know. And the flooding has not affected this in any way, shape, or form?
No, the heavy rains does not impact the fall color. Now, however, the scientists at the DNR Forestry Division mentioned that, you know, if a tree has been flooded, it's been damaged, that could possibly impact the tree, or it could develop some kind of fungal disease from being underwater for so long. But other than that, heavy rain are not a good thing. In fact, you want the trees to you don't want them to be dry.
That is true. What if I'm going hiking, though, and I see a damaged tree because of flooding? Maybe it's uprooted. I'm just kind of guessing here. What do I do?
Well, if you're in a state park, I would tell you the state parks would probably tell you to stay on the trail. That's definitely a big important factor, because you don't want to get off the trail and disrupt the natural resources. But I would let a superintendent know if it looks like it's dangerous or, causing a problem.
And if it looks like it may have a fungal disease from the water, also let somebody at the park know.
Right. I would probably not climb over it or touch it. I mean, that would be me personally.
What is your
on that?
And I know that you're representing the entire state, but tell me your favorite places to go to see fall colors.
Oh, goodness. Let me think about that. I would say the Kettle Moraine State Park. Because it's close. I'm down here in Dane County. I like that. Also, up north woods. The Kettle Moraine State has a scenic drive, and it's through Waukesha County and that area and Washington County. Beautiful, the state forest. But also north, obviously, one of my favorite drives is Hayden. It's Hayward to Glidden, and I believe that's State Route 70. Beautiful, goes through the Shawamagon-Nicolet National Forest. Mm-hmm. Got elk on that. They have elk warning, elk sightings on that route as well. And the state also has a couple of state scenic byways. You have the Door County Scenic Byway, the Lower Wisconsin River Scenic Byway, the Lake Superior Scenic Byway. So these all have been designated routes by the Department of Transportation for their, their beauty.
Great. We have been talking to Lisa Marshall. She's the communications director of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. She was giving us a flood update, and she was also talking about what I need to know to see fall colors. I've been writing down everything you just said. I'm going to be talking with my family about this. Thank you for joining us, Lisa.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We have the technology to keep track of everything our kids do, but should we use it? We're going to be talking about technology and kids this morning with Lisa Damore. She is a clinical psychologist and the director of the Laurel School Center for Research on Girls. She also is a New York Times contributor and the author of Untangled, Guiding Teenage Girls Through the Seven Transitions of Adulthood. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, this book sounds very intriguing to me. I want to know what these seven transitions are. And second of all, we're going to be talking about technology, but we're also going to be talking about privacy today and how to respect your kids' privacy. So let's talk about that first. How can parents balance making sure that their kids are safe and their kids are behaving while they're also being sure to respect their privacy?
Well, so I think the first thing we have to establish is that kids have a right to privacy, that
yes,
wanting privacy is a normal and healthy part of development. And it actually ties back to your question about what these seven transitions are.
Okay.
And so the seven transitions that I articulate in my book about raising teenagers, and I focus on teenage girls, but it applies also to boys as well, are parting with childhood, joining a new tribe, harnessing emotions, contending with adult authority, planning for the future, entering the romantic world, and caring for themselves.
Hmm. Okay.
And so that first transition, that parting with childhood, one of the ways that parents really see that start to happen is that almost universally around age 11, kids start to go in their bedrooms and close their doors and hang out in their bedrooms for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
My experience on this is that usually they are doing exactly the same thing behind that bedroom door that they used to do with the door wide open.
Right.
And so this is a really important developmental moment. And the way I think about it is that kids know that they will soon be leaving. And I know for the parents it doesn't feel soon, but I think, you know, by age 11 or 12, the calculation for the child is, you know, wow, I've lived here twice as long as I'm going to live here. So I need to get used to the idea of being a little bit out on my own. And so I think the way they do that is they say to themselves, well, why don't I treat my room as if it were my apartment? You know, I'm going to live here, and you will be the landlord who occasionally inexplicably knocks. You know, but in the meantime, I'm living my own life here. And I think it's a very healthy and normal aspect of development for kids. I think it's them sort of practicing independence before they are fully independent, and part of how they do that is by having some privacy. Where things can go awry is when the parent assumes that if the child wants privacy, they must be up to no good. And I've seen that, where families think, oh, she's closing her door, you know, what's she doing in there? And then they insist that the door be open, or they start to look at their child sort of, you know, askance. And that is, of course, not good for the relationship between parent and child. So technology comes next, but privacy is important.
Okay, so hang on a second, though. It seems to me that when they're closing their door at age 11, what they're really saying is, you're annoying me, Mom, Dad, and I'm closing the door. And that's also something that parents sort of like get hurt by, and that is just really a normal development stage. You're supposed to be annoyed with your parents when you hit your preteen stage.
Well, I do think that sometimes the child is annoyed with the parent. I think there's also the risk that we run in raising teenagers, and I'm a mother of a teenager myself, of taking behavior more personally than we need to.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So another way we can construe that closed door is that, you know, an 11-year-old is in the 5th grade, 12-year-old in the 6th grade, so they're starting to come into the middle school years. They spend all day, every day, surrounded by humans they did not choose.
Mm.
And they are in close quarters. And everybody is growing up together, and everybody's feelings are getting pretty intense, and everybody's, you know, emotions can be pretty raw. And quite remarkably, middle schoolers hold it together all day, every day, and very rarely, you know, punch anybody or act out or do any of the things that I think, you know, they are working very, very hard to sort of manage their feelings through the day. And I think for a lot of kids, by the time they get home, they need to be alone a little while. And it's helpful to remember how many kids are in a school, how long the school day is, how long the school year is, because then I think when your child walks in the door, goes up to their room, closes the door, it's a lot easier for the parent to think, okay, he needed some space and time to himself,
as opposed to thinking, oh, I haven't seen him all day. Why didn't he want to talk to me?
Yes, we are talking to Lisa Damore. She is helping us suss out how much privacy to give our kids. We're also taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. What is your policy when it comes to teens and privacy, particularly tech and privacy, which we're going to get into in a moment? Do you monitor their social media use? 800-642-1234. Before we get into tech, Lisa, I want to follow up on what you just said. I want to, if my kid comes home from middle school, which could be a very trying time, there could be a lot of bullying. Kids are kind of mean at that age, right? My kid comes home from middle school and she walks upstairs and she closes her door without really saying anything to me. There may be a part of me that's going to worry if she's being bullied, if something is going on in school. So how do I traverse that?
So one of my favorite articles that I wrote, because I write lots, and some I think are fine, and others are like very close to my heart, and this one was very close to my heart. I wrote it for the Times. It was called "Why Your Grumpy Teenager Doesn't Want to Talk to You," because there is that moment where your child walks in and you go, "How is school?" And she goes, "Fine," right? And then she,
right,
you know, walks past you or starts furiously texting, and you think, "What is going on?" And so I have the good fortune that I get to be with large groups of teenagers, and so one day I said to them, "Hey, guys, what is going on, you know, when this dynamic is unfolding?" And, of course, they're amazing. And they said, "Whoa, there's four different reasons why why we do this." They said the first is we already know what you're going to say. We're upset, and we know exactly how you're going to react, and we don't really want to have that conversation. Mm. So, for instance, maybe you told me to stay away from Billy because it never goes well with Billy, and maybe the thing I'm upset about is that, you know, I was playing with Billy today and he was mean to me, but if I mention it to you, I know exactly what you're going to say, and so I'm not going to mention it to you.
I've gotten that answer. I have gotten that specific answer. I'm not talking to you because you're just going to say what I know you're going to say, so I'm going to my room. So, yeah, the second thing is...
Well, and also, they know us better than we know ourselves.
Yes, they
do.
Which
is something, as soon as you accept that, parenting gets easier. Then the second reason they'll say is, oh, it's very complicated, and I don't really want to get into all of the complications with you. So say it's that... If we stick with the Billy example, say it's that, you know, Billy and I kind of run hot and cold, but I also know that in 2 weeks, Billy's having a birthday party I really want to go to. So I don't want to mention to you that we had a conflict today, because in 2 weeks when I want to go to his birthday party, I don't want to hear from you that, you know, I don't want you to raise your eyebrow at that.
Right.
So I can't get into it. A third reason that kids mention, and I think this also, you know, we can put this under the bullying umbrella sometimes, is, you're going to talk too much. You know, if I tell you what's going on, you're going to get on the phone and start, you know, making calls, either to teachers or other parents, and I'm not prepared for those repercussions. And I think that's a very important thing for us to take seriously. And then the last reason is, and a girl said this to me, I thought it was so smart. She said, "Here is the thing. By the time I walk in the door, I am 90% over the thing that got me upset, and rehashing it all from my mom is not going to help me feel better."
I totally agree.
That was so clever. So if you're worried about bullying, I think there's a couple of ways we can attack that question. One is to make sure that we're not confusing bullying with conflict. Conflict comes with being in the same space with other human beings. It's when kids disagree and it's when they don't get along with each other. But there's not a clear power imbalance. So, you know, some days one kid's feeling hurt, the other day another kid's feeling hurt, but they're sort of going at it with each other back and forth. Bullying is when there is a power imbalance and one child is systematically being mistreated and is unable to defend themselves. So it's important on the front end to make a clear distinction between those two, because how we address them really differs.
Mm.
And in short, you know, conflict, our job as parents is to help kids learn how to have healthy and adaptive conflict skills, because they will need those in life. Bullying, really, the adults do need to step in. A child who's on the receiving end of bullying cannot defend themselves and does need help from grown-ups. But even there, we want to go slow, right? We don't want to sort of ride roughshod over the situation and possibly make it worse.
So I want to, before we get to the tech thing, or before we go to break here, I want to talk about privacy for younger children. We've been talking about teens and preteens, but when should you start? What are the things we can do with a five-year-old, with a six-year-old, to teach them that privacy is important?
That is a, I'm so glad you brought that up. So it's actually very easy and very important to start those conversations about privacy young. And the way we can do it with young kids, and the way we should do it with young kids, is to talk in terms of the privacy of their bodies. That, you know, with little kids, they like love running around the house naked and streaking and things like that, and that's okay. But I think those are the moments when we can start to say, hey, you know, your body's private, and you deserve to have privacy around your body. And when you're in the bathroom, you know, why don't you close the door? And when I'm in the bathroom, why don't you not come in? You know, that we can, everybody gets certain privacy, you know, privacy times. And then it's really important to, and I know these are conversations that parents don't always love to enter into, but it's important to say, look, there are parts of your body that are private. And, you know, really it's kind of the parts that are covered by a bathing suit. No one's allowed to touch you there. No one's allowed to ask you to touch them, you know, in the bathing suit parts. And if that ever happens, you need to let me know. So there's a very low-key way that parents can get into that conversation that starts to lay down this sense that kids have a right. And
we are talking to Lisa DeMore, about privacy, and we're going to be going to break in about 10 seconds. We're going to take your calls, 800-642-1234. It's the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about privacy and kids this morning, how much room to give your kids as they grow up, and how much we should keep track of them. What steps have you taken with your children, whether they're little, whether they're teenagers, to make sure that they can trust you and to make sure they know that you respect their privacy? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. That's the email address, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking to Lisa DeMore, who is a clinical psychologist and the director of the Laurel School Center for Research on Girls. She's also a writer. She writes a lot for the New York Times on raising kids. Lisa, we've got a caller here, Delma from Milwaukee. Delma, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I'm calling because I had three teenagers in my household all at once, and now one's a graduate from Madison and one in Atlanta State. Now I have my 15-year-old son, and I've never allowed my kids to close the door to their bedroom. I was brought up with no bedrooms, or just in and out or whatever, but I just didn't let my kids close the doors to the bedrooms because it's a separation. I called that a separation from me to them. I told them that the door open welcomes me there, and you are welcome throughout the whole house. I think that that's a huge separation when you begin to always... I just brought up my kids thinking we have a time to... We eat dinner. This is when we talk, or we can chat anytime. Like my son, I pick him up every single day. We chit-chat on the way home from school. Then we give each other our time, and you've just got to learn to, you've got to know your child. You really do, because on Fridays, we both, Dad and I and him, go for fish fry or whatever, but he knows the routine, and he knows that for dinner we all chit-chat and talk, or and even after dinner, but you got to know your son or daughter, when to give them space, how to. You've got to do a huge routine, and if you have no routine, you have nothing.
That's actually a really great comment, Delma. Thank you very much. So routines matter, Lisa. The things that kids can count on, they know when they can talk to their parents. That is important, yes?
Yeah, actually, there were three really important things that came up in that comment. You know, one is there's no one way in families. You know, there's no single cookie-cutter approach that works for everyone. There's a million ways for families to get it right. And the important thing is that parents not take it personally if their child wants some privacy. But then Doreen said also, you know, you've got to give them their space. When they want their space, you've got to give them their space. And I think that's right. You know, and so space can look a lot of ways. You know, some kids close their bedroom doors. Other kids go out in the woods, you know, for great lengths of time. You know, so there's different ways that kids find their space. But then the issue of routines. I think that, you know, with little kids, but also with older kids,
there is a sense that we know in psychology that predictability makes life work really well for kids, that they need to know what's going to happen next. And I think often when we're learning to be parents and when we're talking about parenting, we say, oh, it's really, really important to be consistent. And that is true. But in some ways, I prefer the language to say it's more important to be predictable, you know, that when we're consistent, we're predictable. Consistent is what we are. Predictable is how the child perceives it. And in order for kids to really flourish, they need to know what's coming next. Mm. They can't be wondering, you know, is this going to be a night when we do it this way or that way, or is mom going to get mad about it this time but not mad last time? And, you know, there can be a lot of irrationality built into that predictability. So, like, and it's fine for kids. So, like, for example, my own mother was very, very relaxed about curfews. Did not care, really, when I came home. She sort of figured, well, when my friends had to go home, I'd come home. Mm-hmm. But could not stand if we left a dish in the sink. You know, if a spoon was left in the sink instead of put in the dishwasher, you know, she'd absolutely hit the ceiling.
Right.
So in terms of, you know, relative stringentness, like, that system made no sense. In terms of making development very possible and easy, it was great because you knew exactly what was coming. And when kids know what's coming, they can then work with that.
We are talking to Lisa DeMore about childhood privacy and more specifically privacy for teens. We're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. You could also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Lisa, what does the research tell us about parents? Do parents normally spy on their teens, or are parents usually pretty laid back?
Well, when we look at it statistically, it's actually parents are in the minority if they are spying on their kids, you know, looking at kids' technology without the kids' knowledge. They are also in the minority if they are looking at their kids' technology, especially around tracking, which is something I've written about recently, if they're doing it above board. So only 16% of parents track their kids, you know, use technology to know where their kids are physically, mm-hmm. and that is largely done above board. What we know from the research is that if a teenager feels their privacy is being impinged upon, that can do harm to the parent-child relationship. So if the child feels that the parent is spying on them, you know, not surprisingly, that does not foster good feeling at home.
Mm-hmm.
So the question, I think the first question we want to ask is, you know, if you're going to monitor your child's technology, should you do it secretly or should you do it above board? And, you know, though I am very rarely a prescriptive psychologist, on this one I will say, if you're going to do it, and there's lots of reasons why you might, you need to be above board about it. Don't try to be sneaky. Don't try to steal looks at their texts or try to find ways to monitor their social media use that they won't find out about, because invariably I think they do find out about it.
I talked in the opening about the app that somebody told me to use, Life 360, and I found it incredibly invasive. Like, my kids knew where I went to lunch, and they knew where I was going, and I knew too much about them. Like, I didn't need to know their daily movements. It sort of freaked us all out. It felt like Big Brother to all of us. Actually, are there other apps out there that parents use, and what do you think of them?
Well, it's interesting. There's lots of things. There's Find My Friends. There's the one called Glimpse. You know, there are lots and lots of technologies that allow us to do exactly what you described. And in recently writing about tracking and doing lots of interviews with families, what struck me so much as I talked to families is that families had come to their decision and they felt very clear in that decision, whatever it was. So some families said exactly what you say, you know, like, no, it feels like too much information. Like, they don't need to know, you know, that I'm running errands, and I don't need to know that they're, you know, over at that kid's house, you know,
right.
And so they say, nope, we're not using it. And I'm just going to expect my kids to call and text me if something comes up or if they change locations.
Yes.
And then other families who I know to have excellent relationships with their kids and be very, you know, level-headed and rational people are like, oh, we love Life 360, you know, that it means that I don't have to text her when I think she's late and I can see that she's just around the corner and driving and I'm glad I didn't text her. And it means that, you know, when my kids are wondering where I am if I'm late to pick them up, all they have to do is take a peek and they know that I am just 5 minutes away or I got stuck in traffic. And so I have to say, it's one of these topics I don't know that I've ever come across where rational parents are in such firm disagreement about how they want to use this technology.
Mm.
And so I think, you know, for me, the take home from that is, how does it feel to the teenager? And are you checking in with the teenager about it feeling like a positive in family life? Or does it start to feel intrusive to the teenager? And if it does, that does need to be taken seriously.
Okay, so I'm going to give out the phone number again, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. And this is the reason, because this is the number one conversation that parents of kind of preteen or almost preteen children have, which is, what age do you get a smartphone?
This is a tough one.
Yes.
So, you know, a lot of this ends up being driven by the community, which, you know, parents may or may not want to have that be what decides this for their family. But it's not unusual in communities for parents to say, like, oh, you know, everybody goes to the middle school in the seventh grade, and that's when we start picking kids up, or that's when the bus, you know, can be late. So, yes, you know, seventh grade is when cell phones happen, and it seems to be happening for lots of kids at the same time. Kids in Manhattan get their phones much easier, earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, everything in Manhattan seems a little sped up, and they are often roaming around, you know, Manhattan. And so it can really depend. I am on the side of parents holding off as long as they want to hold off. And I'm on the side of parents really wanting to slow the process down of a child getting a phone, because it's very much a genie in the bottle. You know, once a child has it, it comes with a lot of power. The times when I have actually recommended that parents who have held off go ahead is when a child is having a hard time connecting socially with kids. In some communities, by sixth or seventh grade, kids start to make all of their social plans by texting or by using some social media app. And there have been times when I've known a really terrific kid whose parents had held the line on a phone, and he or she just wasn't invited to stuff and really wanted to be. And it's not because, you know, the classmates were excluding the child. It's just that, you know, fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth graders are not great about thinking, oh, you know what, Jim doesn't have a phone. Somebody's got to call his house. You know, right. They're not going to do that.
Right.
So that can be a rationale for proceeding.
Should we be looking at our kids' Instagram accounts?
It's a really tough question to answer in terms of a straight yes or a straight no. I do think when handing over a phone to a child is a great time to make all the rules you're going to want to make, because the motivation to get that phone is very high, and kids will agree to a whole lot of things, and I think it's worth writing them out. My generic advice on this would be that parents reserve the right to look at kids' social media as part of funding the phone. And the rationale that parents can give is, look, it is fundamentally public. What you put up on social media is public and permanent. And if the whole wide world can see it, we can see it too.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think the question becomes, how closely and how often is the parent going to try to monitor a teenager's social media? And, you know, in truth, that could be a full-time job. And most parents have other things they need to do with their time. I think what it really comes down to then is, do you know your kid, and how much can you trust your kid, and do you need to be monitoring daily? Do you need to be doing once-a-week check-ins? Do you need to say to them, look, I'm not looking that often, but if I hear anything out in the community about how you've conducted yourself, I'm going to ask you to open and show it to me.
We are talking with Elisa DeMoor about privacy and teens. We're going to come back in a moment with your calls, 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on this network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking about kids, mostly teens. I was sitting here talking to Sarah, who is running the board for me today, about this, about growing up, and how her mom dealt with privacy issues. We are talking about how you deal with privacy issues today. 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Elisa DeMoor, we were talking about teens and social media. You were saying that it kind of depends on the kid in terms of social media. What social media would you not recommend teens go on at all?
You know, there's always some fresh new awfulness available on social media. You know, I think Yik Yak was one recently that was really unpleasant for kids. There's also been ones where kids can post anonymous feedback to one another, which invariably was used to say really yucky things. I think that it's very hard for parents to, on their own, stay abreast of the latest unpleasantness and unpleasant apps that can be put to good use or bad use. I think the best thing out there is commonsensemedia.org, which is a website where very, very smart and thoughtful people do stay on top of this for parents. And so every time there is a new app or a new possibility online that I hear about from teenagers, I'll hop onto commonsensemedia.org, and they've invariably got a really thoughtful review and good advice to parents. So for me, they have been, both as a parent and also as a psychologist, a really valuable resource in knowing what's out there and what to do in terms of giving advice to other parents and then also parenting myself.
We are taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. Margaret from Green Bay, welcome to the program.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you. This is such a great program to hear. And I do have a question. I am a high school teacher, and we are constantly reading these studies saying that our students have no one to open up to. They don't have any adults that they can trust. They don't have anyone that they can, help them through hard life circumstances. So how can I, as a teacher, give my students privacy, but also, help them do things?
Okay, so Margaret's phone kind of went out. She's probably driving to work right now. So what is it that she can do to help teens who are very private, or help them, let them know that she's there to talk to them, I guess?
So, Margaret, I'm so glad you asked this question. I think, especially on the school side, the most powerful thing a school can do is to make sure that the teenagers do feel that there's an adult they can talk to at school, because sometimes teenagers, for lots of reasons, don't share as much at home anymore. And one of the things I universally advise as schools are thinking about their social and emotional programming is that they go get their six bluntest juniors, because juniors are very direct and smart and willing to still engage in a very, serious way with life at school. And get those six bluntest juniors in a room and say to them, if you were really worried about yourself or a friend, is there somebody here at school you could tell, an adult here at school you could tell? And then hear them out. Because sometimes they will say, well, no, we wouldn't tell an adult at school. And then you need to find out why. And if you chase that question down, there's a whole lot of answers you can hear back. Sometimes the teenagers will say, well, we don't really trust you to keep it, to be discreet with the information, or, this happened 2 years ago and you guys blew something small up at the way, something way, way too big. But take very seriously, if there are hesitations on the part of the juniors, take them seriously and then figure out what would get in the way of them sharing that information. And then take very diligent steps to fix whatever barriers they articulate. And then I think you have to go back to the whole school and say, look, we got feedback about why you guys didn't feel comfortable telling us things, and these are our steps we've taken to address them, and we really hope you will trust us going forward. But that, for me, is the number one thing schools can do to support students and also to make sure students are safe. Usually, under good conditions, there are adults that teenagers will talk to. It is not always adults at home, and it doesn't have to be. But in my view, every teenager needs one grown-up at least in their lives to whom they can go if they are really worried that something's wrong, or if they just need to talk and they need some support. And there are things adults do that get in the way of that, and we need to find out what those are so that we can address them.
One grown-up that is not necessarily their parents.
Absolutely. And it's okay if it's not the parent. And I think that's hard for parents to hear. But this is why we have great teachers and great coaches and great advisors, is that in the course of normal development, it's the job of teenagers to loosen their ties at home a little bit and to strengthen their ties to adults outside of the home.
Well, we are talking about privacy in teens. Lisa, I want to get to this point. What if you have a teen who isn't very communicative, whose behavior has changed recently, and you feel like they are getting depressed, maybe they're doing drugs, they're hanging out with people that they didn't normally hang out with before. What do you do then?
So what you're describing is exactly all of the flags that we would worry about. You're right, a teenager who just doesn't seem themselves, And I would also say, and that this lasts for more than 24 hours. You know, I mean, I think in the normal course of development, we see a lot of ups and downs with teenagers. So, you know, if a teenager has a rough day, I think parents can just set that to the side and just be supportive. But if it is persistent, where the teenager doesn't have ups and downs, is actually seeming to have consistent downs, or has changed their friend group, or doesn't see themselves, then I think parents do need to level up their sort of sense of concern. From there, there's a couple of things they can do. One is, hopefully the child is at a school that the parent trusts and feels good about. And as a first sort of small step, I think the parent should reach out to somebody they really trust at school and say, you know, have you noticed something with, you know, with Tom? Like, he just doesn't seem like the way he was before. You know, are you guys seeing something at school? And just try to get some more information about what's going on. Then I think the next best step is to sit down with the teenager and say, look, you know, I'm worried about you. You know, you just don't seem the way you used to seem. Is everything okay? And really try to approach it head on. If the parent remains concerned or if the child remains really squirrely, I think that's a great time then to reach out to a mental health professional who specializes in working with teenagers and either offer that to the teenager as an option, and if the teenager refuses, then the parent should go as their own option and get coaching from somebody who deals with teenagers all the time about how to sort out what's going on, especially if something's really off the rails.
What role do siblings play in this?
Siblings can play a lot of roles. You know, one of the things that makes family life not that fun is that the relationships between siblings can be pretty combustible at times, and siblings often get into it. It is also not unusual in a family with a teenager for the teenager to take out their frustration with the day on a younger sibling. This is something I hear about a lot, where a teenager who had a rough day and held it together and comes home in a pretty bad mood crosses paths with, you know, maybe a 8, 9, or 10-year-old sibling who is maybe being just, you know, completely fine or maybe being slightly annoying, and the teenager has a very, you know, kind of disproportionate response. You know, it's really nasty or says something that cuts really deep, and then, you know, the parent is angry that, you know, younger child is devastated and the teenager is fuming up in their room. You know, that's a very common and extremely unpleasant, you know, set of events in family life. I think the best thing in that situation is to comfort the young child and then go find the teenager after things have cooled off a little bit and say, look, you know, you may have had a horrible day and we are here to support you, but you know it is completely out of bounds, you know, for you to talk to anyone in this family that way.
Is it? Does it happen where teenagers, and we have about 30 seconds, where teenagers who may be a year or two older, going to high school with that kid, come to the parent and say, there's a problem, I'm seeing a problem?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It definitely will happen that teenagers will say, I'm worried about myself, I'd like to talk to somebody. And I think any time a teenager says that, it should be taken extremely seriously. And, again, parents can either partner with their school or their pediatrician often is a good first stop to figure out sort of how to address that question and you know, what professionals might be useful to call in. But I think that anytime a teenager comes forward with a concern about themselves, you know, we should definitely listen to that and hear them out.
Lisa DeMore is a clinical psychologist and the director of the Laurel School's Center for Research on Girls. She is a New York Times contributor and the author of Untangled, Guiding Teenage Girls Through the 7 Transitions of Adulthood. Lisa, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.